greatest quality you can possess is luck. It had a profound effect on me. I'd spent my life being nervous.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which you hear from those who made a difference. John Humphreys.
My childhood was a childhood of smells, because there was the smell of my father's French polishing, a lot of which he did in the kitchen, self-employed, because he'd had a tough life himself. He'd gone blind when he was 13, and he used some absolutely disgusting concoctions to strip off the old polish and things like that. And my mother, the hairdresser, doing lots of perms. And in those days, I don't know about now, but in those days, the smell of permanent wave solution was utterly disgusting. So that was the sort of financial background, precarious, to say the least. Sometimes fine, absolutely fine. Tiny little house, outdoor lavatory and all that kind of thing. But we didn't go hungry. Well, sometimes there wasn't much food, and sometimes it was sugar sandwiches for tea. Bearing in mind that tea was what posh people would call supper, I suppose. My father showed little interest in us. In most respects, he was too busy trying to earn a quid or two. My mother was a very, very good mother. The greatest gift she gave us was her absolute determination that we should not end up as she had ended up. She wanted us to be educated. She didn't know anybody who'd been educated. I mean, she didn't know anybody who'd gone to university. None of us did, or anything like that. But nonetheless, she knew that education was what mattered, and she made us do homework. I think we're probably the only kids in the street who did. My father bought a subscription from the door-to-door salesman to Encyclopaedia Britannica. So we had that in the house, being delivered every week or every year, whatever it was, every month, I suppose, until you had all volumes. I think it cost a shilling a week or something. Anyway, whatever it was. And we did our homework. We were forced to do our homework. And the result of all that was that all of us got into good schools, grammar schools, called on grammar schools in those days, called the high schools. And I went to a decent school. I didn't like it. I hated the school. It was a snobbish school. I was the only poor kid in my class. It was intensely middle class, obviously. Headmaster was, I thought, a bit of a thug. I remember him beating me once because I was late for school, because I used to deliver newspapers before I went to school in the morning. We needed the money. And it was a snowy day, snowing quite heavily, and the papers were very late arriving at the newsagent, so I was late delivering them. And I explained that to him, but it didn't matter. He couldn't quite get this idea that there were kids out there who were poor enough to have to deliver newspapers before they came to school and things like that. So I was pretty... I didn't like school. I wasn't happy there.
Up in the sky, look!
It's a bird!
It's a plane! It's Superman!
I knew from a very early age, 5 or 6 probably, exactly what I wanted to do, because I read Superman comics. It was one of the three things we could afford, because they, in those days, post-war, immediate post-war days, the Americans sent vast numbers of second-hand comics over to this country as ballast in freighters. And they ended up in newsagents where they'd be sold for, you know, halfpenny a piece or whatever. So I read loads of Superman comics. And, of course, Superman was Clark Kent in the real world, and Clark Kent had a beautiful girlfriend called Lois Lane and had an amazingly glamorous life, and of course was able to nip into a kiosk and turn into Superman in a flash. So I thought, yeah, well, if I become a reporter like Clark Kent, maybe I could be Superman. Or you might say, that's okay when you're 5 or 6, but with me, it stayed for the rest of my life. I still secretly believe that one day I'm going to be able to nip into a telephone kiosk.
This is the BBC Home Service. It has just been announced from Buckingham Palace that Her Royal Highness Princess Elizabeth, Duchess of Edinburgh, was safely delivered of a prince at 9:14 p.m.
Radio was, you didn't call it radio, of course, called it the wireless, and the wireless was a big influence. We had a huge, as did everybody, even poor people, mostly anyway, big wireless set, glowing valves, monster of a thing. You could only get, well, you could get the home service pretty clearly and the light program pretty clearly. We tried eventually to get Radio Luxembourg, but failed at that. But, radio was important. I can remember listening to From Our Own Correspondent.
And in the middle of that demonstration, there's a call box at the side of the road. And I can go in, I can put 10 cents in, and I can dial London, and I can do an immediate piece with the door of that phone box open, and London can actually hear the noises going on while I'm doing it. You can't do that in television.
Charles Wheeler, even, because he'd been around a long time, Anthony Lawrence, and I remember listening to those voices of those men reporting from a world I didn't know. Nobody in my family had ever been abroad, so we didn't know anything foreign. And there were these great men broadcasting to us, and there was a large part of me that thought, wow, imagine doing a job like that. I never thought for a second that I would.
When I first went out to the Far East, there was only the one man in Singapore. We had nobody in Tokyo, of course nobody in Peking, nobody in Hong Kong. So one was travelling an enormous amount, and that meant long absences from home, and that's never very easy.
My father loved Sing Something Simple on the light programme. Every Sunday evening, I think at 6 o'clock, we would have this Sing Something Simple being belted out. Well, you belt out, you can't belt out Sing Something Simple. It was, I thought it was pretty dreary stuff, but he loved it. But that was the only music we didn't have. The third programme or anything like that. No. Sing Something Simple. That was about the height of our musical reach.
We'll sing the old songs like you used to do.
I left school at the age of 15. On the Friday, went on the Monday to the offices of the Penarth Times, a small seaside town just outside Cardiff, nearest local paper, weekly to me. So I went there, asked the proprietor, Roland Harris, for a job, spun him a story, but I knew that he wasn't interested in intellectual academic achievement, but he was besotted with sport and things. So I lied and said I was a great cross-country runner, which I wasn't. But he said, just what you need to be a reporter, that sort of thing. Stamina, yes, all right. So he gave me a job. £1.17 and 6 a week. I mean, I suppose I was a trainee reporter, but I'm not sure you can be a trainee if there's nobody sort of senior to you, teaching you, as it were. And there was another young kid. We didn't really do very much reporting as such. I mean, a lot of the time I do remember sitting in the local library going through back issues of the Penarth Times for a feature back in the old days or whatever it was. And I'd go through the old copies of the Penarth Times, find something interesting, or probably not interesting, deeply dull in truth. But it provided copy. It was free, didn't have to pay for it, didn't have to go anywhere, made great effort, and it filled the columns of the Penarth Times. Because people bought a local paper, largely, they liked court cases, and I did spend a lot of my youth in the local magistrates' court. Mostly, I mean, it wasn't exactly heavy-duty stuff. It was mostly somebody caught peeing against a wall in the street after he'd been to the pub all night and usually fined a shilling. So I did that, and not much else, as I recall. No, I did. We began. Roland, the proprietor, had ideas way above his station, really. He decided that Cardiff, the great city on our doorstep, needed a weekly newspaper as well, so he produced the Cardiff and District News. I was the teenage page editor. The thing I remember most about it was that I delivered the newspaper to newsagents in Cardiff with an old lady, I think her name was Lillian, who had an ancient Austin 7, and we would put the newspapers on the back seat of the Austin 7, and we would go drive around the newsagents in Cardiff, and we'd hand out the papers, and they would, some of them, not many, would take them on condition, obviously, sale or return. So if they didn't sell them, you'd have to pick them up the following week, which we did. In short, we sold very, very, very few, if any, copies of the Cardiff and Disinews. It was a total failure and very quickly went bust. The one thing it did for me, because I had this title, Teenage Page Editor, and I had a double two pages to put in it what I would, and I conned the theatres in Cardiff into believing that I was a figure of some significance. They never met me, of course, so they didn't know I was only 16. And it meant I could get free tickets to theatres when big acts were there. One of my big exclusives, at least it was planned as a big exclusive, was I managed to persuade a theatre in Cardiff to let me interview their stars when they came every so often. And the greatest star of her day, greatest singer of the last century for my money, was Ella Fitzgerald. And she was due to do a gig there. And I asked the theatre if they could arrange an interview with me beforehand, and they said they thought they could. And so off I trotted and arrived at the theatre hour before the show, or whenever it was. They took me up into her dressing room and tapped on the door, and I was admitted. And I was, I think it's fair to say, wetting myself. I was terrified. I mean, I'm 16 years old, pimply little kid who knows nothing about nothing. And there was this great worldwide star, I mean, a great international, a greatest singer of the day, and a hugely terrifying woman. I mean, she was very large, and she stood in the dressing room wearing her glittering gown that she was about to wear on stage. I was absolutely terrified. I got into the room, I walked into the dressing room. I was so nervous, I was kind of, you know, ganglion shape. Anyway, my elbow caught a mirror and knocked it to the floor, and it smashed. And she saw it happen and heard the crash, and she went ballistic, and she said, "Get that fucking kid out of here." And they lifted me, her mind has lifted me by my elbows, took me to the door of the dressing room and slung me out. And that was the end of my great scoop.
The very thought of you, and I forget to do.
I left the Pennard Times, went to a bigger weekly newspaper, the Merthyr Express, stayed there for a couple of years, then got a offer of a job on the Western Mail, which is a daily newspaper in Cardiff, the national daily. Did better than I thought, because I was offered a job then by the Sunday Times. They invited me to come up to London. I'd only been to London once before in my life, to have lunch with the big boss. And I did, in a very grand restaurant, Simpsons in the Strand. Never been in such a place in my life. And they wanted me to join their Insight column. I was 21 at the time, and I accepted. Came out to Cardiff, went for a beer in the local pub where all the hacks go, used to go, and a mate of mine had just got a job at TWW, the local commercial television station. And he said, "What do you want to go to Pennard Times, Sunday Times for? Newspapers, you want to go in telly." So I said, "All right." So I applied for a job at TWW and got that as well, told the Sunday Times I wasn't going to join them. They were very cross, and I started in the glamorous world of local television. I remember being in the TWW newsroom and seeing on the telex machine, a ticker tape machine, that there'd been a coal tip had slid in the valleys, in the Merthyr Valley. I knew the Merthyr Valley very well because I'd worked for the Merthyr Express. And mostly the coal tips just slid and somebody got injured occasionally, and that was about it. But I knew the village where it had happened. The village, of course, was Abervan, Merthyr Vale. And I knew there was a school in the village, and the tip was above the village, on the hillside above the village. I drove up there, and when I got there, I saw the sort of scene that nobody should ever see in their lives, and it was pretty much beyond description. I did describe it, of course I had to, I was the first reporter on the scene. The village, the centre of the village where the school was, had disappeared. It took me a little while to comprehend it, because instead of just driving off the main road down through the valley and down into the village. You couldn't do that because the road no longer existed down into the village. Instead, there was this absolutely monstrous heap of waste, colliery waste. This is where the school should have been. Standing on top of it were miners. They'd been down the pit, which was just very close, and heard this great roaring noise, and they knew, even though they were below ground, a long way below ground, but they knew exactly what it was, and they rushed back to the surface. And when I got there, they were there on top of this great mound with picks and shovels. Couldn't use machinery because of the danger of collapsing stuff into the school, but most of the school had already been crushed. But they were digging for their own children. It was the most unimaginably awful scene you can imagine. These were strong men, and their faces were still black from the coal dust, obviously, and there were white streaks down them from the sweat and the tears, because they were digging for their own children. Every so often, one of the miners would shout for silence, and we'd all go completely quiet, just stand there, not moving, because they thought they might have heard a child crying out. Sometimes they did, and I saw one little girl being rescued. She was, she was about 9, I suppose, but mostly they didn't rescue children. They found their bodies, and over the next few days, they'd retrieved 116 dead children and 28 adults. It had a profound effect on me. I mean, it's appalling to suggest that's why it was important. It was important because endless numbers of families had their lives destroyed, and I didn't. I was just an observer. So to say it had a profound effect on me is pretty grotesque. But what it did do to me as a youngster, a young journalist, was it demonstrated to me that authority must be challenged all the time, because that dreadful, dreadful disaster need not have happened if the National Coal Board, who were in charge of the deep mines in Britain in those days, had listened to what the miners in Aberfan had told them when they decided to build that tip some years earlier. And, of course, the coal board lied. They'd insisted that they'd not been warned that it mightn't be a place, and so on. And, of course, they lied through their teeth, and Lord Robins, the bastard who ran the National Coal Board. Lord Robins, dear God in heaven, Lord Robins. I watched him lying in at the inquiry. Unfortunately for Robins and the rest of them, they'd had letters, and their copies of the letters came to light. So what it told me was that authority is not to be trusted. My father was right all those years ago. I wouldn't claim any credit at all for getting at the truth. The men themselves got at the truth. And it's outrageous for journalists to say, I didn't reveal anything. I was a messenger for other people, that's all.
They've been called murderers, responsible for what happened, which is nonsense. I mean, that's all he was paid for. And like myself, was tipping for the muck. The quicker you get rid of it, the better it is for you. I mean, as far as the safety of the tip is concerned, nothing to do with us.
I got offered a job at the BBC a couple of years later. Opened a bureau in Liverpool, television news bureau in Liverpool. There wasn't one in those days. Covered the northwest for the BBC. Stayed there for a couple of years. Interesting job, very interesting job. Mostly dock strikes and things like that. Beatles and aftermath of the Beatles and all that. Then I became the industrial editor for the North, which was a northern industrial editor, which was an important job, a very important job in those days, because obviously there was a lot of industry in the North. So I moved from Liverpool to Rochdale. Then the BBC offered me a job in London. London was, I didn't quite know what to make of it. I mean, obviously, I'd never lived in London. But I'd lived in Liverpool, which is a big city. I'd lived in Manchester for a bit, which is a big city. So I don't think it was any particularly intimidating or anything. But obviously the story, I mean, the kinds of stories that one did. I mean, that was when I had my first foreign assignment, first important foreign assignment. They sent me off to what was then East Pakistan. One of the points I've always made about my career, and indeed about journalism in general, is that the greatest quality you can possess is luck. If you get lots of lucky breaks, the odds are you'll be pretty successful. And I've had loads of lucky breaks, like when I went to East Pakistan. I'm not lucky for the people there, but I'd only been there for 24 hours, and I was asleep in my room on the top floor of the Intercontinental Hotel. Great banging noises, thumping noises, and the hotel started shaking. Anyway, it was the Indian Air Force attacking Dhaka, capital of East Pakistan, and that was the start of the Indo-Pakistani War. I woke up my camera, and we shot off to the airport. The only ones who were there, only journalists who were there, so it was exclusive. And while we were filming the destruction that the attacks had caused to the airport and the so-called East Pakistan Air Force, didn't exist any longer, very great craters everywhere, the planes, the Indian Air Force, came back again to have another go at it. And I can remember running with my camera and jumping into a crater, a bomb crater. And while they came literally over, I mean, feet above our heads, firing off rockets and going, I've never been so scared in my life. Absolutely terrified.
Well, we haven't been here for more than 7 or 8 minutes at this airfield, and in that time there have been 3 strikes. This is the third one coming over now. There's the big guns firing. There's a saber just gone overhead. And that's how close they came to hitting us. I suppose not more than...
I think probably that was the most frightening thing that had ever happened to me. Other things. It's sometimes the most frightening things are when you are confronted, when you can, as it were, see the whites of their eyes. I did a fair bit of reporting from Northern Ireland during the times of the Troubles, and the BBC was hated. It began with the nationalists loving us, cheering us in the streets because they saw us as the saviours, in a sense. I mean, they saw Britain as the British government was finally going to send in troops and deal with the unionists who had made their lives miserable for so long. But that didn't last very long, of course, and the IRA, provisional IRA, came along. And on. But we were regarded at various times, the BBC, as the enemy, whoever you happen to be. And I do recall one day we got attacked. My camera and I were filming whatever it was, a demonstration or something, and they turned on us. The crowd turned on us. And that's scary when you've got, as it were, your own people, people that you know, and I spent a lot of time in Belfast. And then you get turned on by a mob who want to do bad things to you. And it is scary. We escaped, but only just. Peter, our cameraman, was... had the car keys, and he jumped into the car. But then they tried to block us, and then they started... Somebody chucked a paving stone or whatever it was through the windshield, and the car, it shattered, and Peter nearly lost his eye, and he was driving away with blood streaming down his face. That was horrible. He recovered from that, and obviously I wasn't hurt, but it was scary, nasty.
The army expected trouble, and they got it. At least 120 shots were fired at the soldiers. 8 of their men were hurt, 4 of them with gunshot wounds, and were taken to hospital.
Well, in the early days, I wasn't at BH, at Broadcasting House. I was at Television Centre, which was where television news was based in those days. I think I felt pretty intimidated. I mean, not paralysingly so. Obviously, I'm a reporter, for heaven's sake, and you're meant to be have a pretty strong brass neck. But, yeah, and there were 1 or 2 reporters there who could have been but more friendly, is that the right word? But reporters are competitive, obviously, highly competitive. If there's a good story going, only one of you can go and cover it. So we were very competitive. But I learned to be competitive, I think you could say. In the early days, we're talking about the late 60s, mid-60s and on, the culture, very different from what it is now. Most of the reporters, most of the journalists came from newspapers. The Express was a very popular newspaper in those days, and there was a lot of foot-in-the-door journalism. we were regarded as the rough, tough kids. You know, we weren't properly civilized. We reporters, we were sent off to do, you know, to nasty places to get stories, and there was none of the oh my goodness, are we going to offend somebody if we report this or do that or whatever? None of that at all. It was foot in the door stuff. And also, there was none of the safety culture that exists now. I mean, I can remember being sent to wars without anybody saying, you know what, you might get killed or something, or kidnapped or something horrible. Here's what you do. There was never any suggestion of that. You just went and you did it. And there was you and your cameraman, and maybe your sound recordist as well. And you just did it. Some people, a good friend of mine, lovely bloke called Ted, he got blown to bits in somewhere. And it happened. People did get killed and wounded in all sorts of different ways. But it was regarded as par for the course. I mean, I'm not suggesting that people didn't care about it. Of course, they cared massively. But it was regarded as what happens, the risks you run. That was how it was in those days. Now, of course, we have health and safety, and rightly too, I suppose. I personally never been a great fan of some of the training that reporters now have to, not just reporters, producers, everybody have to undergo before they're allowed to set foot, well, before they're allowed to cross the road, basically. They have to have all these different courses, spend weeks doing it sometimes. My entire time, I did agree eventually to go on one of these courses because they were very keen that I should go to Iraq after the war, and obviously that was a war zone, and the rules were quite clear. If you hadn't done one of these courses, you had it. And the course lasted a week, and I said, well, I'm not going to go for a week. So my boss then said, well, I'll tell you what, we'll go. Oh, and I said to my boss, yes, I remember the conversation, I said to my boss at the time, I tell you what, I'll go if you come with me. Anyway, he said, to my great surprise, into slight dismay, really, he said, all right. So off we went on a Wednesday morning to this country house with extensive forested grounds where the people were taught how to dodge grenades and things like that. It's all a complete waste of time, I thought. And we had an agreeable lunch. Then we had dinner, very pleasant dinner, and a couple of lectures. That was a useful lecture about first aid. That was all right. Following morning, we wandered around the forests with a bloke from the Marines or whatever telling us what happens if you get kidnapped, and pretending that this was a bomb and whatever, all that nonsense. And we stayed until lunchtime, had another rather agreeable lunch, and went home. That was it. That's the extent of my training.
From Washington, this is NBC Nightly News. Wednesday, July 24th.
Good evening. President Nixon has not yet responded to the sledgehammer decision of the Supreme Court today, which ruled that he must immediately turn over tapes of 64 presidential...
I got sent by the BBC to New York in the early 70s to open a bureau, a television news bureau. We didn't have, believe it or not, a television news bureau in the United States, so I was sent out to set it up in New York, slightly bizarrely.
During that time, Gilmore, although angered by the temporary stay, was in good humor most of the time. And he remained calm as he was led out of the maximum security block to an old warehouse which had been converted into an execution chamber.
And my luck, I have been very, very lucky all my journalistic life. My luck kicked in 3 days after I arrived. I think it was 3 days after I arrived in New York, never having been to America before in my life. Watergate broke. Biggest political story there has ever been in the United States, and I was there. And when I came back to the States, having set up the bureau, spent a few months doing that, came back to this country, to Britain, and they advertised for a correspondent to be based in the United States, television correspondent. We didn't have any based abroad. We had people who just pop out and do something and come back again. Anyway, we opened four bureaus, and one of them in the United States, of course, which covered North and South America, quite a big patch. And I got that job. And then, of course, spent years reporting on Watergate. Charles Wheeler, the greatest journalist of his day, knew everything about Watergate, about Washington, about the White House, massively well-informed, brilliant, brilliant man. Bizarrely, freakishly, the BBC had moved him out of Washington and sent him to Brussels, which was crass beyond belief, and I can only believe that it happened because the government of the day, Ted Heath, had put pressure on the BBC to upgrade the Brussels bureau because of Heath's enthusiasm for Europe. And that's why. Anyway, for me, of course, it was manna from heaven because I was then the man who did Watergate. And I had another hugely lucky break when it was reaching its climax, everybody wondering whether Nixon would resign or not, be forced to resign. And I got a call from a bloke I knew. He used to be a neighbour of mine, Congressman Peter Pizer. He rang me one morning and said, I've just come from the White House. Are you interested in what Nixon told me? I said, you better believe I am. And he said, he's going to go on television tonight. I whoopee-doo. So I got on to London, told my foreign editor that I wanted them to mount a satellite. Big thing to do in those days, cost $10,000 dollars a shot. And he said, you've got to be kidding. And I said, oh, this is a big story. I'm going to tell the world that Nixon's going to resign tonight. And in the end, he agreed. And I did. And thank God Nixon did resign.
Throughout the long and difficult period of Watergate, I have felt it was my duty to persevere, to make every possible effort to complete the term of office to which you elected me.
I don't think anybody's ever done a story in their life, a big story, I mean, which, with the benefit of hindsight, you wouldn't have done differently. I was pretty pathetic in the early days. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't have any contacts. I distinctly remember underplaying Watergate in the very early days, saying on one of the circuits, the conference calls that we had between the States and London every morning, saying, nah, I don't think this is going to turn into much. Yeah, right. Yeah, that was a good call, wasn't it? And eventually, of course, I did get the hang of it, but it took me a while. Well, I was new. I knew nothing. I knew nobody. I was an innocent.
I have never been a quitter. To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my body.
I wanted to come back. My family wanted to come back home from Washington, because I'd been traveling so much. I was based in Washington, but covering the whole continent, north and south. And I told them I wanted to come back, and they said, all right. And then at the last minute said, can you make a bit of a diversion? Can you go to South Africa? Because they've allowed us to have a television news bureau in South Africa, which the apartheid regime had not allowed previously. So I said, all right. And my long-suffering wife gritted her teeth and said, all right. So I went down to South Africa. Again, the old bit of luck kicked in, and the president of South Africa, within a few months, had to resign, and I'd done an interview with him.
Many people say South Africa inevitably faces internal revolution because of its racial policies.
People have said so over a period of 300 years. And today, South Africa is one of the most peaceful countries in the world to live in.
And then, of course, apartheid began not to crumble, because it was very fierce, very vicious in those days. But nonetheless, it was a massive story. And South Africa borders Rhodesia, of course. It used to be Rhodesia. Zimbabwe, there was a guerrilla war going on, so I spent a lot of time in Rhodesia covering that war, and was there on the night that Robert Mugabe became president of the new Zimbabwe. That was another big story. Again, right place, right time. When you've been a foreign correspondent for quite a long time, you get used to meeting, if you're in those days, certainly, if you were the BBC, you had a great deal of access. I mean, even in the United States, where the broadcasting companies were very, very powerful, NBC, CBC, ABC, CBS, ABC, and so on. If you were the BBC, you did get access to a lot of people. I mean, I interviewed Ronald Reagan a number of times. I met Nixon, invited to the White House, all that sort of thing. So you kind of got used to the fact that because you were the BBC, you would be given access to an awful lot of very powerful people. But I didn't expect that to happen in South Africa. I didn't think Botha would agree to be interviewed. I was very surprised when he did.
But doesn't simple justice suggest that blacks should be treated exactly
simple
the same as
justice
white?
Suggest that you must allow a black man with his family to live a healthy, decent life. And you must provide the work where possible for him and not allow him to come and squat on your doorstep.
When I came back to Britain, eventually, I'd been promised by the then head of news that I would become a newsreader. It appealed to me because I didn't want to do any more travelling. I'd had enough. But he reneged on the promise because he said he wanted me to be in the international, whatever the hell he called me at the time, which meant that whenever a big story happened anywhere, I would go and do it. And I said, I don't want to do that. You get stuff. But of course, in the end, I did, but agreed to do it just for 1 year, which I did. And then I became a newsreader, the first journalist to present the 9 o'clock news, which became the 10 o'clock news. But of course, in those days, it was the 9 o'clock news with a huge audience. And I did that for the best part of 6 years. Got bored very quickly.
A defeat for the top men at the TUC. The members tell them, change the rules.
Well, I was a bit recognisable because I'd been on telly a lot anyway, obviously, doing all the stuff I'd done from America and Southern Africa and all the rest of it. But it was slightly different. You got recognised everywhere you went. You just get used to it. It's no big deal. People make a big fuss about it. I can remember one of my colleagues who'd become one newsreader saying, oh, it's terrible, you know, you can't go anywhere without being recognised. Well, the answer to that is perfectly simple, isn't it? If you don't want to be recognised, don't go on telly. Nobody makes you. Now, I used to get a bit cross about that, for heaven's sake. And anyway, it's not a problem. You know, somebody says, oh, yeah, can I be ordered? Oh, you do. I mean, so what, you know? And let's be realistic about it. It gives you a high profile and
Two Northern Ireland policemen have been killed in a landmine ambush. And the ambush on journalists in Angola by South Africa.
I've spent my life being nervous. I mean, haven't you got to be fairly stupid not to be nervous about something you're going to do that either you haven't done before or that you don't think you're capable of? And in my very, very early days, when I was 15 and working alongside guys, young guys, and nearly always guys in those days, who'd been to university and had training at this, or whatever, they'd spent a year under this scheme or that, whatever it happened to be. There were no media studies degrees or courses in those days, thank God, but nonetheless. I was a kid. I was just a kid, spotty kid. So, of course, I was nervous. I didn't think I'd be able to compete with these intellectual titans. And I managed to cope. But of course, being nervous, yeah. I mean, I'm still nervous before, or at least right up until the time I stopped doing the Today programme, still nervous about before a big interview. You'd have to be. You've got to be stupid not to be, it seems to me, or at least so complacent and so pleased with yourself that you can't do the job properly. I was nervous when I did Classic FM. I've never done anything like that before. Sort of upmarket DJ, I suppose, introducing Mozart or whatever. I'd never done anything like before. And of course, I was nervous of that. I mean, haven't you got to be?
A very good morning to you from John Timpson in Dublin on the final day of the Pope's visit to Ireland. After a memorable weekend of religious enthusiasm, of deep emotion.
I came home one night from doing the 9 o'clock news. It was, and the late news. I got home at about midnight, 11:30, I think. There was a phone call. He'd been trying to ring me all night, apparently. The deputy editor of the Today programme said John Timpson is going to retire at the end of this year. That was in, I think, it was September, I think. Anyway, he said in a couple of months that John Timpson's going to retire, the then presenter of the Today programme with Brian Redhead. Do you want the job? And I said, yes. I didn't argue. I didn't discuss it. I didn't say what kind of hours will I have to work, God forbid. How much money will I get? I just said, yes. I'd always fancied doing the Today programme. I was bored, rigid, doing reading from an auto cue in front of a camera, and the chance of doing something completely different. I'd never done an interviewing job before of any sort. I was huge, and I remembered it, of course, from my childhood. I mean, I hadn't heard it for many years while I was based abroad. I was out of touch to that extent, but when I came back, I listened to it every morning, obviously. And I was thrilled a bit and said, yep, you bet. Right call, too. Being terrified. I remember the first programme. I remember my first programme. I don't remember my first programme. I just remember sitting in the studio for 3 hours, mostly kind of panicking and wondering, what on earth can I do next? How am I going to be able to think of another question? Am I going to be able to do this? Awful. Terrified. Absolutely terrified.
It's 7:10. As you heard in the news, there are growing suspicions that that hotel fire in Puerto Rico was started deliberately.
Working with Brian Redhead, for instance, was both an education and a pretty fearsome thing because Brian had a temper. Boy, did he have a temper. Partly exacerbated by the fact that towards its closing years, he was pretty He was pretty ill one way and the other. Didn't admit to it, but anyway, his temper was pretty fearsome. We almost came to blows in the studio once because I'd been foolish enough to mention something that he'd just done in Russia and suggesting that perhaps he'd been a little generous to the communist authorities or whatever, and oof, boy, I live to regret that.
Do you think we should have a one-minute silence now in this interview? One, for you to apologise for daring to suggest that you know how I vote, and secondly, perhaps in memory of monetarism, which you've now discarded.
And the newspapers loved in those days, they don't much care now, to make mischief about who was the top dog. And so everybody, of course, wanted to be the top dog, and you measured that by whether or not you got the 8:10 interview on today. Still do. And I'm not suggesting for a second that nobody cares about that any longer, but that doesn't attract the sort of attention that it did, I think, in those days. So it was, still is, it's always going to be, a highly competitive environment. There is only one 8:10 interview each morning, and all the presenters want to be the one who does that interview. Of course, you'd expect that.
George Entwistle, let's come to that question of your position a bit later. In this interview, let me ask you first, what went wrong?
Well, we made a film that relied upon a witness who yesterday came out and said he'd made a mistaken identification. That mistaken identification meant that the film we had broadcast was wrong.
So it's highly competitive, but by and large, even though you were in competition with them, you rubbed along well. I felt so anyway. I mean, somebody like Justin Webb, for instance, had become a very close friend of mine over the years and so on. I've never had a problem working with anybody. Justin and I are very similar in lots of ways, same sense of humour. We've always got on terribly well. And I've worked with him now for longer than with anybody else. But he's a great guy and an absolutely first-rate presenter.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb and John Humphreys.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with John Humphreys and Sarah Montague.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with John Humphreys and Edward Sturton.
This is Today with James Naughty and John Humphreys.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with John Humphreys and James Naughty.
And the man who makes sweet music from a carrot, a pepper and a courgette. We'll explain how.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with John Humphreys and Evan Davis.
Before any big interview, I will spend many, 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 many hours poring over everything that's been written, studying it within an inch of my life, so that by the time I say good morning, Mr. or Miss whatever, so-and-so, I will be fully briefed up to my eyeballs. And if you'll believe that, you will believe anything. Sometimes, if it's a big interview with the Prime Minister about something frightfully important, yes, you will spend a lot of time preparing. Mostly there's an element of flying by the seat of your pants. I'm one of those who does not write down questions. I don't do that, partly because I can't get my act together sufficiently. And when I go in the morning at 4 o'clock, I'm endlessly finding excuses not to prepare the interviews that are coming up. And so when they actually happen, I'm talking in the present tense, even though I stopped doing the programme quite a long time ago. But nonetheless, it's quite difficult to get out of talking in the present tense. I did it for so long. Yeah, I tried to persuade myself that if you over-prepare for an interview, then there's no element of surprise. That's a bit pathetic, really, but I cling to that. I like the idea, I persuade myself, that the best interviews are those where the audience feels you are having a conversation with the person, with the politician. I mean, I'm talking here specifically about politicians. Interviewing real people is fine, doesn't matter. I mean, if you don't know anything, that's okay. I mean, you're interviewing a famous scientist about whatever it is, you can say, I haven't a clue what you're talking about, can you please tell me? Gosh, isn't that interesting? Can't do that with a politician, obviously. You have to pretend that you know everything, which of course you don't, but that's the impression you have to try to give. But if you have all your questions written down, I think you're probably not listening the way you should be listening, because it is, after all, a conversation. And the most important aspect of any interview, the most important, the thing that the interviewer should do, above all else, is listen. Listen to the answer and then follow up, if necessary, on the answer. What you don't want to do is and this is what used to happen in the bad old days of news broadcasting. The interviewer would go into the studio with his list of questions, again, pretty much always his list of questions prepared, and ask those questions, come what may. It's not like that any longer, thank heaven.
Good morning.
Would you accept, Mrs. Thatcher, that you, as much as anything, more than anything perhaps, have become the issue in this campaign?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that...
John Burt once warned, and we thought at the time Paxman and I were his targets. Jeremy Paxman and I were his targets. John Burt wrote a piece deploring the rabbit. This was when he was Director General of the BBC, deploring the rabbit punch style of interviewing, where you start out with a tough question, a tricky tough question, and then everything flows from that. I think it was a bit unkind. I don't think I did. Well, maybe I did. Maybe I did. Anyway, and I've come over the years to believe that John Burt, his lordship, was right, that we probably were a wee bit too aggressive on occasions. Sometimes, in my case, once or twice. Well, I can think of one particular example. I lost my temper with a politician. It's unforgivable. You should never do that. I think I've never done it since. The audience hated it, quite rightly. The inevitable question that everybody always wants answered is, haven't you been too aggressive? If you'd been a bit gentler, if you'd been a bit more interrupted, a bit less and so on, you would get more out of them. Sometimes that is true. Mostly, I think it's probably not true. The politicians know exactly what they want to say, and it almost doesn't matter what your question is. They will say it one way or the other.
Parliament that we're electing is the next parliament. That's
quite
what
sure.
will happen in the next general
election.
Yes, but
you're not saying keep the pound as a matter of principle. You're saying let's keep the pound for the next 4 or 5 years.
Saying the government elected at the next election would keep the pound, and you can't get
not forever.
Clearer.
Well, you can. You could say we'll keep the pound. Forever.
It's the job of people like me to, obviously, old cliche, but it's the job of people like me to hold power to account, or to tell truth to power, whichever cliche you prefer. And you have to do a bit of interrupting. If you did no interrupting, if you never interrupted a politician, you would get a party political broadcast, and that would be very boring.
There were two occasions when colleagues took it upon themselves to complain that I'd been interrupted on the radio, and it was not at my request, and I couldn't understand what on earth they were going on about. My reaction when interrupted by Humphreys was to interrupt his questions if he was going to interrupt my answers.
Of course, criticism gets to me. You'd have to be, well, unbelievably arrogant. So, of course, it does. But I tend not to expose myself to it. I put it this way, I do not subscribe to Twitter. I have never knowingly tweeted in my life. I never read what people who do use Twitter say about me or anybody else, because I never read Twitter at all. I used to get terribly worried when people phoned the BBC to say that Humphreys is awful, get rid of him. I think, oh my God. And in the end, you do develop a fairly thick skin, I suppose, but the sensible way to deal with it, it seems to me, is by and large, not ignore it, but try to get it into perspective. I mean, I got, over the years, obviously, I've had vast numbers of letters in the early days and then emails, and I have always read all the letters and always read all the emails. And usually, well, I've tried to reply to most of them. Most people have been pretty kind, and when they've criticised, this is the kind of people that listen to the Today programme, I suppose. I mean, they're decent, thoughtful people. And when they've criticised, they've probably, most of the time anyway, been right. But it doesn't, in my very early days, it used to keep me awake at night. It doesn't any longer. And the trick now, as far as I'm concerned, is ignore social media, which I do happily.
People know me well enough and realise the type of person I am to realise that I would never do anything either to harm the country or anything proper. I never have. I think most people who have dealt with me think I'm a pretty straight sort of guy, and I am.
The John Humphreys problem emerged after Labour had come to power. Only a few months after it had come to power. And when the Tories were in power, Labour regarded me as the John Humphreys solution. I was a hero. And it took about 4 months to realise that actually I wasn't a hero at all. I was a villain. And that's because all of a sudden, instead of kicking the what's it out of Tory ministers, I was doing the same to Labour ministers. And they seemed not to realise that that was actually one's job. BBC was a bit too, in my view, a bit too... They fell, some in the BBC, some of the big bosses, fell for the idea that everything was going to be different when we had a Blair government, because what a sensible, moderate chap he was, wasn't he? Wouldn't life be wonderful? Well, no. He was a human being, he was a politician, and life wasn't going to be different. And certainly I didn't change my approach. If they're in power, then they have to answer. That's the view I took. And the first time I had a properly aggressive interview, I mean, I thought I was being completely moderate. So did my editor, which is what matters. But nonetheless, they got very upset. They wrote a letter to the BBC saying something must be done about the John Humphreys problem. And in other words, you've got to be sacked, otherwise we won't continue to work, and so on, so on, so on, so on. And we got over it. They eventually give up. I mean, they tried. Alistair Campbell was pretty brutal at times, but you know, so be it. That's his job, I suppose. At least I don't like the way he did his job, never have done, but there you go.
And I was always of the view, when Tony asked me to work for him, that we had to change the terms of the trade, that the press had been, frankly, setting the political agenda, particularly when John Major was in power, less so with Mrs. Thatcher, but certainly with Major there, and in a way that, in my mind, was detrimental to the interests of the Labour Party. So we did make changes.
My main recollection is Margaret Thatcher, because she was my first Prime Minister on the Labour Party. She was coming up to an election when I joined the programme in 1987, and I did the last interview of that election with Thatcher. And learned very, very quickly that you shouldn't take her for granted. And I concocted a brilliant wheeze to throw her, destabilise her right at the start of the interview, because I figured that if I went down the old route about what mess the economy was and all that sort of thing, she'd deal with that very easily. So I figured I'd ask her a question about her religion and ask her what is the essence of Christianity, and I was convinced that she would say something like love or charity, and I would be able to say, you talk about love, charity, all that, there's countries in a dreadful, dreadful financial mess, kids going to school without any shoes on their feet and all the rest, and she'd be devastated and I'd resign on the spot and I'd be a hero of the grateful nation or something like that. Of course, it didn't work like that at all. She was completely unfazed by the question. She snapped back one word, choice. And I thought, oh my God, how am I going to deal with this? And from that day to this, well, she died quite a long time ago, obviously, but I thought, this is somebody you've got to be awfully, you've got to think through what you do with Margaret Thatcher. She was tough. And yes, it did. But I still, to this day, all those years have passed since then, of course, but I still think, my God, scary business interviewing Margaret Thatcher.
How can you express unselfish love if you have no choice? I understand, I'm not going to get into the fundamentals of Christianity. The fundamental choice is the right to choose between good and evil. Is that not right?
The
fundamental reason of being on this earth is so to improve your character that you are fit for the next world.
One morning I was doing the programme, nothing terribly much happening. I'd done an interview at about 6.30, just after 6.30, with a senior Soviet Union official in Moscow, Gennady Gerasimov. She had obviously heard it. Anyway, 5 minutes later, whatever it was, my producer came into my headphones and said, I got Thatcher on the phone for you. And I said, yeah, right, sure, rubbish. Of course, you haven't taken the piss or whatever. And a second later, the voice of the Prime Minister in my ears, good morning, Mr. Humphreys. She picked up the phone when she heard the interview with Gerasimov in the kitchen of number 10, picked up the phone, told the switchboard to put her through to Mr. Humphreys, and there she was. And imagine that with a modern Prime Minister, eh? And it was a joy. I mean, I asked her whatever it was she wanted to say and then said, well, since you're on, I suppose we should do a proper interview, shouldn't we? She said, I rather thought we might say that. All right, go ahead then. And off we did.
We have on the telephone now from 10 Downing Street, Mrs. Thatcher, who I gather has just heard the news, Prime Minister.
Hello, good morning. I heard it on your news briefing. It was the first indication we've had.
I decided to leave when I was about 60. I thought that'd be about right. I'd have done whatever it was, 15 or 20 years, whatever it was. And I didn't. And then I decided, well, maybe 65, and so on. And I kept putting it off and putting it off and putting it off. And I signed a contract to write up my book. I mean, I've written lots of books, but the book about my, you know, sort of memoir thing. And obviously figured I couldn't do that while I was still on the programme, but I'd leave the programme in a couple of years. So I signed the contract and then still didn't leave, still couldn't bring myself to it. And eventually I thought, this has become ridiculous, and decided that I would give the BBC a date, which I did. And then, and that was about 8 months, I think, before, 10 months before I actually did leave.
Sarah Sands, the editor of Today. So, Sarah, I've seen your tweet. Is it true? Is he going?
You can ask him when he comes out.
So he is going. When is he going?
What? He'll tell you. No, there is no date. There is no date. Honestly, you're talking about Gandalf. We have no idea. Stories come from nowhere.
What is it about John? You call him Gandalf. He is a sort of a wizard of news.
Yeah, well, he's a sort of patriarch, so it is a big thing. If by any chance, at some point in the future, he leaves us. But I think he is still always, you know, the little boy who throws stones, doesn't he? So I think he's still as suspicious of power as he ever was.
And kept thinking, oh, God, oh, God. Anyway, but it was too late by then. I'd given them a date. And that was it. As the day drew closer and closer, I thought, oh, what am I going to do? But I did it. And I'm not sorry I did it. It's quite nice not getting up at 3:30 in the morning.
Mr. Cameron, good morning.
Good morning.
That was a false promise, wasn't it? You misled the nation.
Well, first of all, can I just take a moment and say thank you for 32 years of striking the fear into politicians like me every morning and asking us questions that we don't always want to answer and calling us to account. It's an amazing...
Well, fortunately, it was a very busy last day because two Prime Ministers, well, Tony Blair, former Prime Minister, and David Cameron for the 8:10 interview, so I couldn't indulge myself too much, although the programme were very, very generous and they'd done some lovely bits about my past, you know. So-called greatest moments or worst moments, whatever. But they were incredibly generous. And when it actually came to do my goodbye bit, I'd originally intended, I told the boss that my original intention was not to announce my departure. My plan was that I would say at about 8:55, I would say, thanks very much for listening. Our editors were so-and-so and so. And by the way, this is the last programme I'm doing. I've decided to leave the day programme and thank you all for listening. Good morning. That was my plan. They said, don't be ridiculous. A, it'll leak. B, you can't do that. And so on. And so I bought it. So we had this lovely, lovely programme. The thing that I remember probably most is that former Chief Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, Lord Sacks, comparing me, he did his little thought for the day based on me as an Old Testament prophet, which I thought was completely wonderful. I mean, it's so surreal that I still boggle at the idea. But when it came to do my last few words, I came close to tears. I don't think I actually blubbed on air. I think that's pretty... anyway, but yeah, I was very, very... It's been a huge part of my life, obviously the biggest part of my life professionally. I enjoyed it enormously, couldn't imagine life without it. But the water closes fairly swiftly over the heads of departing presenters, and I'm enjoying my retirement. Retirement? What a ridiculous idea. I've been busier than I've ever been. But I am enjoying not being a part of the Today programme any longer. I miss it, of course, hugely. But there are so many other things to do, and you can say things that you couldn't say before when you were part of the programme. Obviously, you're allowed to have opinions. You're allowed to admit, for instance, in my case, that I voted to remain in the European Union. Well, you couldn't say that before, so therefore you could not engage in debate on any kind of personal level. And all of that is good. And you can do different kinds of things. I mean, I just made a film about trees. I did classic FM, introducing Mozart and Beethoven instead of bloody Brexit, and all of that, which is wonderful. So I am enjoying what is not, positively not, my retirement.
Welcome to Classic FM. My name is John Humphreys, and I'm the new kid on the block.
I want to be remembered as a journalist who did his damnedest, who did not let them, if one's talking about interviewing people, who didn't let them get away with it most of the time, occasionally, might have rattled their cages a bit, but did what the audience wanted, asked the questions the audience wanted asked, and persisted not rudely, not aggressively necessarily, but persisted and tried to get the answer as a reporter. I think I did a few stories where I broke a wee bit of new ground, and I think by and large, and this is the most important thing that a journalist can do, and it takes me back to the horror of Abervan and the way that those desperately, desperately sad people and their children were treated, that what matters is it's not my phrase, but it's a well-worn one, and it has stood the test of time, is speaking truth to power. People in a democracy have an absolute right to feel that there is somebody out there who is fighting their corner. And if I've done that in a very modest way, then that's how I'd like to be remembered. John Humphreys. For more in this series, follow the Radio Moments Conversations podcast.